Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President throwing down the gauntlet on extending middle-class tax cuts and speak with the Washington editor of Altenet, Adele Stan. We'll discuss the coming battle over the so-called fiscal cliff and how long the Republican House will be able to hold up a deal as they fight to preserve tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. Then we'll examine the report on climate change commissioned by the CIA that was released on Friday by the National Research Council. The lead author of that report, John Steinbrenner, joins us to discuss the unparalleled strains that climate disruption will place on the U.S. military and intelligence agencies in the coming years, not to mention the human and environmental cost as our endangered planet convulses with more frequent and unpredictable crises caused by global warming. Then finally, we will speak with Michael Lind, the author of Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. We will discuss our economic future that may soon be held hostage by another Tea Party tantrum, or whether a more adult consensus and compromise can be reached in Washington. Michael Lind has an article at Salon.com, The Final Defeat of Backlash Politics. Joining us now is Adele Stan, who is Altenet's Washington Bureau Chief. She has an article on Altenet.org, Obama Throws Down Gauntlet to GOP on Fiscal Cliff, Extend Middle-Class Tax Cuts Now. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
And the president, clearly both sides are sort of positioning themselves and laying down their markers. But the president, I thought, was very effective in his press conference where he held up his pen and said he's ready to sign a bill right away. I'm ready to do it. What's your sense of how long, is the president going to, or are the Republicans in the House boxing themselves into their position of fealty towards the millionaires and billionaires? And will that eventually become manifestly clear to the American public?
Yeah, I think it was a very clever move by Barack Obama. And it was sort of a different Barack Obama than we've seen. He seemed to be saying, if you recall, when George W. Bush won in 2004, he said, well, I have political capital and I intend to spend it. I mean, that's really kind of what I got from the president. Now, the Republicans really have boxed themselves into a corner. And, you know, there's all kinds of recriminations going on within their own party about what happened as a result of the election and whether or not that was a repudiation of that, as you say, billionaire coddling agenda. So what Obama did was he came right out of the box and said, hey, well, you guys are against anybody's taxes going up, and we're against taxes going up on the middle class. So, hey, why don't we just agree right now not to raise taxes on the middle class? You know, that there's already a bill that's been passed in the Senate. Just need the House to pass it, and here's my pen. I'm ready to sign. And it was a very effective television moment that was, I'm afraid, would have been the big news of the day had it not been for the news that came later that afternoon about the CIA director.
Well, scandal always trumps substance. So, and need I remind you, Adele, that you're not living in France?
Yeah, we surely are not.
So it looks like in this case, two of the mistresses were at each other's throats. So we'll find out what's going on there. But there's a lot more, obviously, to learn on the Petraeus story. I was speaking to a former CIA officer this morning who told me, gave me some information that was indicated that what we're hearing now is really pretty ridiculous. We're not really getting the real scoop.
You're not getting the real dirt. Oh, no. You're going to help us find it out, Ian?
I'll do what I can. But today we're talking about far more important things, which is which is the economic future of the country. Obviously, the Republicans are going to use this canard that they've got that we're not really protecting the millionaires and billionaires. We're really protecting small business. And that's what they keep saying, that they want to preserve tax cuts for small business. But the president pretty much addressed that as well. Do you think he shot it down?
Well, I don't know that he has shot it down entirely unless he continues to develop the idea. But what he said in his very brief remarks from the East Room of the White House on Friday was that if Congress would sign that, if Congress would pass the proposal that that was passed in the Senate, what it would do was it would cut out tax cuts. I mean, it would extend the tax cuts on both the middle class and, he said, were 98% of Americans and 97% of small business owners. Because the ruse that the Republicans like to put forward is that that people who make more than $250,000 a year, a lot of these people are small, quote unquote, small business owners. But what they're including in those small businesses are hedge funds. I mean, and these small financial firms that deal in millions and millions of dollars and whose owners make millions and millions of dollars for themselves. So, I mean, that's really what's going on here.
So, in other words, Mitt Romney's a small businessman.
Yeah, he was. I mean, yeah. You know, Bain didn't employ all that many people. Bain Capital didn't employ all that many people. So, yeah, so that's how they like to define it. And it's just, you know, it is ridiculous, but I do think that theme will need further development before it sort of sinks in. And I think it would require probably a real public information campaign by perhaps labor unions or some outside group, you know, doing video and television to kind of get that idea into people's heads.
Again, I'm speaking with Adele Stan, who's AltaNet's Washington Bureau Chief. She has an article at AltaNet.org. Obama throws down gauntlet to GOP on fiscal cliff, extend middle class tax cuts now. She also has an article on voter suppression tactics backfire on GOP galvanizing voters' resolve, which we certainly talk about. But it seems to me that the president has really got to this time, I think, keep campaigning, in effect. What happened in 2010, Karl Rove organized the American Petroleum Institute and others to fund the takeover of various state legislatures by Republicans, particularly in the key swing states. They used this shadowy group, ALEC, as a vehicle to do this. And they were very successful in 2010, and that brought about control of the House. And the problem with midterm elections is that not as many people vote, and particularly not as many Democrats vote.
Right.
So we saw what happens when Democrats vote. The president gets reelected, and they increase their majority in both the House and in the Senate. If they don't do that in 2014, we're going to go back to the future again. It'll be a repeat of what happened in 2010, won't it?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, Ian. I really have to keep this get-out-the-vote machine going. And the danger in that is that so much of that get-out-the-vote machine was in the Obama for America campaign, in the president's campaign. And that campaign is now folding, right? Now, which doesn't mean all the apparatus will go away, but, you know, they were supposed to have been, in 2008, been creating a new organization out of that infrastructure called Organizing for America, which never really, you know, gelled. They really need to keep that infrastructure intact and also, you know, I think remind people that there are nefarious forces afoot that want them not to vote.
And as you point out in your article at AltaNet, Adele Stan, voter suppression tactics backfire on GOP, galvanizing voters' resolve. Now, obviously, you're not saying that there's anything acceptable about people lining up for 7 hours, which is what they did in Florida, to vote.
Oh, no, not at all.
But what you are saying is that you know, people really were offended by Republican efforts to deny them the vote, and they stood their ground. But something has to happen, surely, to fix this disgusting system. It's just embarrassing.
It is embarrassing, and it's morally wrong. It's just wrong, wrong, wrong that 48 years after the Voting Rights Act was passed, we're still dealing with these kinds of things. And that it's very clearly targeted at Democratic constituencies, most of, a lot of which are people of color. So the trouble is the structure of the way the U.S. election system works, which is that, you know, Congress deals with our rights as citizens of the United States. That's what our laws are about. And the Supreme Court ultimately is the arbiter of whether that what Congress passes is constitutional. But elections are in the hands of states and localities and how those elections are conducted. So that is makes the whole thing quite unmanageable. Unless there is a new federal legislation that defines those rights and limits the means, that also defines the means by which those rights will be accorded, say, mandating a uniform time of early voting across the states or similar kinds of ideas and measures or issuing a national ID that anybody can get for free because, you know, these ID laws are requiring people to purchase these IDs, basically. When I go to District of Columbia and get just a state ID, it costs me, I think $20. So, which amounts to a poll tax. So, I mean, unless, there are all different kinds of ideas for doing this, but ultimately, we're always going to have a certain measure of election disparity because, of the way the elections are administered by the states. And there's a very strong Tea Party caucus in the House, which is all about states' rights.
Well, also, you've got the Supreme Court that are all about states' rights. And the Voting Rights Act is now, through a South Carolina case, is now before the Supreme Court. And it's very possible, in fact, even likely, that the Supreme Court will do to the Voting Rights Act what they did to the McCain-Feingold campaign finance laws, which is eviscerate them. And that will then, I mean, we just had the experience in Texas where the Voting Rights Act of 1965 struck down efforts to impose voter IDs and other restrictions on minorities. So we can see that it's still working. But the Supreme Court, the conservatives on the Supreme Court are in an alternative universe.
Well, indeed they are. And, as far as the Supreme Court is concerned, the conservatives, they seem to think that everything's all fixed structurally, that after 350 years of slavery and then another, 100 or so years of outright,
Jim Crow
and discrimination, that now 48 years later, everything's fine. And what is up before the Supreme Court, my colleague at Alternet, Steve Rosenfeld, is our elections expert, and he's written about this case, is that the Voting Rights Act, what it did was it required states that had a history of preventing people of color from voting that they now had to submit to the federal government their plans for making the polls accessible to people, and they had to do this regularly every time the act is renewed. These states are challenging the saying that the situation has been rectified, everything's fine, and it's time to get the federal government out of their elections. Well, hey, not so fast.
So
those lands in Florida. That's right.
Well, that's what's so disturbing is that the evidence is so manifest. But when Justice Scalia was recently interviewed by NPR, he about Citizens United at the height of all the super PAC money pouring in, with all of its the 501c4 dark money shielding the donors. I think it was Nina Totenberg, he said, well, there is disclosure in Citizens United. Well, she, unfortunately, she didn't ask the follow-up. What are you talking about, you know?
Right.
So that's what's scary about these guys, is that they either believe it or they don't. Maybe they're incredibly cynical. They're just political hacks. I don't know. It's terrible to think that you could even consider them political hacks, but they sure seem to be behaving that way.
Well, I mean, going back to the 2000 election, they kind of revealed themselves to be that, you know, partisan and political people. So, I mean, I think that with this election, one of the reasons it was so very critical, the outcome, was because of the court. But it doesn't mean that in the interim that the court that exists in its present form couldn't do a great deal of harm to voting rights. But if we have any indication by, you know, and we have to say about the turnout in this election, the Obama machine, of course, was astonishingly good at turning out their voters. But also you had a lot of groups involved in election protection who were educating people about, you know, how they could challenge authorities when their right to vote was being prevented, and that kind of thing. So I think that we're going to see a lot of pushback if, as you say, the campaign stays alive and people stay organized.
Well, Adele, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who is Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief. She has an article at alternet.org, Obama Throws Down Gauntlet to GOP on Fiscal Cliff, Extend Middle Class Tax Cuts Now. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the lead author of a new report on climate change commissioned by the CIA. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Steinbrenner, Professor of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, where he directs the Center for International and Security Studies. He's the author of a number of books, including The Cybernetic Theory of Decision, New Dimensions of Political Analysis, Principles of Global Security, and A New Concept of Cooperative Security. He co-chairs the Committee on International Security Studies for the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and was the lead author on a report on climate change by the National Research Council that was commissioned by the CIA and other intelligence agencies. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Steinbrenner.
Thank you.
And the report that just came out on Friday was supposed to come out, and isn't it pretty extraordinary to think that you had and others had worked so long on this report and you're about to deliver it, and its delivery to the United States government was delayed by Hurricane Sandy, the superstorm that most people recognize is connected to global warming.
It was quite ironic. It was an amazing event, actually, but we found it notable that the briefing was scheduled for the day that the hurricane hit.
So what is the sense amongst the intelligence people, the customers for this report that you've done? They're pretty much on board this. I remember speaking to a group of CIA officers who had just returned from Australia, and they'd done a briefing down there, or they'd been briefed down there, and they were kind of surprised that the Australian intelligence service considered global warming its number one priority. And this was a few years ago. So tell us about the learning curve here in the United States. Have we been behind it, and has our intelligence service been behind it?
There's no question that our political system as a whole is running way behind it, in part because of the prominence, frankly, of the deniers who want to pretend that the problem doesn't exist and don't want to hear about doing anything about it. But I think it's fair to say that anybody who is exposed to the environment, that would be all farmers, are very clear that global warming is happening as a problem, and most of the government agencies are as well at the professional level. Congress, of course, reflects the divided political opinion.
Again, I'm speaking with John Steinbrenner, professor of public policy at the University of Maryland, where he directs the Center for International Security Studies. He co-chairs the Committee on International Security Studies at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and was the lead author on a report on climate change by the National Research Council that was commissioned by the CIA and other intelligence agencies. I've spoken in the past with a Canadian researcher, Cleo Pascal, who wrote a book called Global Warming, how the global warming will change the planet and change the geostrategic landscape, which it already is apparently doing in the Arctic with Russia and even China and Canada all vying for navigation rights and also for mineral deposits. So, again, tell us about how the global geostrategic landscape's changing and how our intelligence services are waking up to it.
Well, you identified the most prominent thing occurring is the Arctic ice is melting and to the point where it is very likely to disappear in summer, opening up a shipping route that's much shorter, if you will, from Asia to Europe, for example. And so there will be jockeying, if you will, for position. But in the end, it's more like the main asset there is shipping through a 3 or 4 month period when the ice is not present. And it's reasonable to expect that standard rules will be worked out there so that everybody benefits, really. The deeper story is that the global warming phenomenon is a very severe threat to the globe as a whole, and that dealing with it, I mean, decisive mitigation is going to require not national competition, but intimate collaboration among societies that are not used to it. And in particular, unless we transform, if you will, energy generation in India and China, over the next 40 or 50 years, we're going to lose the battle on global warming. And that means there's going to have to be much more detailed engagement with those societies, financing, technology transfer, in order to develop the alternatives on pace. And that means we're going to have to alter the security relationships we have with those societies. The biggest story there, of course, is U.S. and China. Unless those two countries can collaborate, we are in big trouble. And at the moment, they're not prepared to do it.
Well, apparently, Republicans in Congress have objected to the CIA's creation of a climate change center, and they've tried to deny money for it.
That's what I informally understand. That was not part of this study, but that does seem to be part of the background.
And indeed, the capability of our weather satellites and that whole program is being underfunded and underfinanced. So we may be in a situation where not only are we behind the curve in terms of our recognition of a real problem, but we may be behind the curve in our ability to predict exactly when and how and how big these weather events are going to be.
It's true. Prediction, what you're saying, is very difficult here. I mean, short-term prediction they're very good at, and although there is some threat to the ability to do that, but longer-term prediction lasts more than 3 days or a week, is problematic. Nonetheless, you want to do the best you can, and the assets used to provide information are not being tended and developed to the extent that they ought to be. That's part of our point, is that we need to do monitoring, much more systematic monitoring, and we need to develop a monitoring system that bits and pieces of it exist, but not a system. And So there are two stories here. That some of the current assets are degrading, and even if they were not, it would not be adequate.
Well, we just witnessed, of course, an election here in the United States where global warming was not mentioned by either candidate in any substantive way. And I think the reasons were that they were all competing in the coal states for votes. And coal is the real problem here, or the worst problem in terms of producing CO2. And China depends upon it enormously. And the Obama administration is trying to cut it down, but obviously it's running up against these electoral realities. What's the agenda that's necessary in terms of coal? Because this idea of clean coal is a complete myth from what I understand. And the coal companies, even though they keep taking credit for clean coal, they haven't invested a dime in it.
Right. Clean coal is an oxymoron. Those two words just don't go together in terms of climate effect. The people who want to argue that we can safely use coal have to believe in carbon sequestration, where you clean it up and put it on back underground. And there's a legitimate debate about that, but I think it's pretty clear that you cannot take that technology from up to gigaton levels safely, because if you put it underground and it leaks, and particularly if it surges, you've just worsened the problem enormously. So although there's a debate about it, I think reasonable expectation is that when we get through with really vetting the various alternative energy technologies, carbon sequestration, which is, synonym for putting coal back underground in a safe fashion, it's not going to make it. You're not going to be able to do that on the scale required. And therefore, coal, we're going to have to allocate away from coal much faster than it actually runs out. And that's not good news for those people in that current industry. But fair warning, you need to be in a different business because we simply cannot tolerate the consequence of the environment. And, they don't want to hear that. And I don't blame them, actually. It's disruptive to their lives. But that's not a message that's debatable. That is going to be reality. You cannot deny it. It's going to get you eventually. And so the word to them is begin the process of getting into a different business or a different technology. There's plenty of time to do that, but you're going to have to do that.
So, again, I'm speaking with John Steinbrenner, Professor of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, where he directs the Center for International and Security Studies. He also co-chairs the Committee on International Security Studies at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and was the lead author on a report on climate change by the National Research Council that was commissioned by the CIA and other intelligence agencies. Now, just to give our audience a sense of the gravity of the impact of global warming on the planet and how, as a result, there will be geopolitical upheavals which fall in the category of national security and international security. The Nile River watershed, where there's an enormous amount of conflict already over water and farmland, and if you combine the populations of Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia, they're approaching 300 million people. And my understanding is that South Korea and Saudi Arabia have purchased a lot of the land in the Nile Delta to feed their own people. And this is also happening in South Sudan and in other parts of Africa. Enormous amounts of land are being purchased, often by European and U.S. and Gulf interests. So if global warming really adversely affects, say, the Nile Delta, then you're going to have a competition between the foreign landowners like South Korea and Saudi Arabia and the local people, right?
Everything you say is correct, but that is not a particularly prominent climate story at the moment, because we don't have any solid reason to believe that global warming is affecting the flow of the Nile. I mean, there is increasing pressure there. But with that said, the food markets are getting global in character, and so we have to take that into account. At the moment, almost all the Egyptian food supply is grown somewhere on the Nile watershed, not necessarily in Egypt, but in the surrounding. But Egypt can be supplied from greater distance. we have to worry about is climate disruption that affects the global food supply or food demand or supply and demand balances, and that could occur anywhere. If you're looking for a river watershed that looks alarmingly vulnerable to climate-induced disruption, you look at the Indus River, not at the Nile.
The Indus River in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and there have been some substantial floods, too, have there not, in Pakistan?
Yeah, that is a different climate phenomenon, but it's one of the expectations that the climate scientists are now seeing is that you're getting increasing extremes on both ends, greater drought in drought areas, greater floods in flood areas, and Pakistan gets whipsawed back and forth between those two things. And that's one of the phenomena hitting Pakistan. The Indus River water flow appears to be substantially less because of an anomalous situation in the Karakoram glaciers that feed it. And that is a climate story. And in addition, increasing temperatures are disrupting their product cycles. And so Pakistan is getting hit pretty badly by climate-induced disruptions. And, you know, you could say that this is a slowly unfolding crisis. It's not acute as yet. It's the equivalent of a chronic infection. And that's big trouble because Pakistan obviously is quite a fragile society. And the fact that they're experiencing very severe internal pressures associated with this is something that we all ought to pay attention to.
Well, my understanding is already climate change has altered the agricultural landscape in Australia, for example. They used to have some of the biggest rice exports in the world, and that entire area has just suddenly dried up, and that whole business just went out. They just went out of business.
Yeah, you could argue, I don't know the details, but rice farming has been done in places where it shouldn't have been done. Central Valley in California, for example. It's not a good use of the water resources in those particular places. So some of the adjustment is not necessarily bad, actually. It's just forcing, finally, efficiencies that we should have recognized much earlier. But the general point, however, is that global warming will affect agricultural product cycles in many places, and that you know, the net consequence is not something that we adequately understand at the moment. But we need to begin to think hard about it and trace it, track it. Part of what we're saying in this report is that the United States as a whole, not just the intelligence communities, but all the U.S. agencies, need to put together a monitoring system that includes both critical climate variables and social variables having to do with the reaction to climate change. So that we are monitoring circumstances in greater care, greater fidelity than we currently are. Because of our inability to predict exactly, we need to get early warning where trouble begins to emerge.
Well, already the U.S. military have adapted. They've spent billions on fuel efficiency, but they've also, the Navy's gotten involved in alternative fuels for obviously good reasons. If the Straits of Hormuz are closed, for example, and there's a major disruption, the military has to be able to operate on alternative fuels. And believe it or not, the Secretary of the Navy is being attacked by Republicans in Congress for hedging.
Right.
And it's just, it gets you back to this sort of know-nothing aspect of our polity here, where you've got this, in effect, the entire Republican Party are locked into global warming denial. And, you know, the American Petroleum Institute gave the most amount of money in the 2010 election, which brought the Republicans into control of the House. So you have this moneyed interest in funding denial, which is a national security problem, clearly, and it will get worse. Are there countervailing powerful interests, for example, on Wall Street? Wall Street just got its feet wet in the Hurricane Sandy, literally. You know, the water came lapping up at Wall Street there. Insurance companies and the insurance industry have recognized global warming. So in terms of getting allies, powerful allies, to get past this impasse that we have over denial, what can happen here, John Steinbrenner?
Well, the phenomenon itself is relentless. And so virtually everybody is going to feel it and that ultimately will win the argument. The question is, okay, who is most likely to get out in front of this in a constructive way rather than a denial way? And the insurance industry is probably the best candidate because they unquestionably are encountering the phenomenon and beginning to recognize the very severe effects it can have. I mean, we are looking at increased frequency and severity of violent storms. And that is a problem for the insurance companies, and they're beginning to recognize it. I think it's very difficult to predict, if you will, what the trend of attitude in the United States is likely to be in any short period of time. But I think over a lengthier period of time, the global warming will impose itself, and everybody involved is going to have to recognize that. And the people who are trying to deny it just lose the ballgame eventually. The question is, how much damage do they do in preventing, if you will, both reasonable adaptation and mitigation measures before they do lose the argument. And time matters here. So it is true, I think, that the advocates so far up to this point have been less vocal, less well-financed, politically less prominent, at least in the United States. That will change. It's hard to tell over what period of time.
Well, just in closing, John Steinbrenner, what kind of time do we have, though? I mean, we can't. The amount of CO2 that's being pumped in the atmosphere is at a record level, and it's exponentially getting greater. And the planet is telling us in no uncertain manner that it's being affected. What kind of time frame do we have before too much denial reaches a point of no return?
I wish I could answer that question better than I can or anyone can, really. What's the problem here is interaction between geological timescales, which operate over large numbers of years, and human timescales, which operate over smaller numbers of years. And the question is, what is the intersection of those two going to be? And I think all we could say is that there is prudent reason to believe that in the course of the next decade, we are going to encounter climate-induced social disruptions that are a good bit more serious than anything we've seen before. And they will occur probably at surprising times and places. That's the most you can say, given what we know. But if you do believe that, and I think it's prudent to believe that, I would say that within a decade, most of the world is going to waken up on that, and we probably won't encounter some experiences that really do rivet attention. And human beings being what they are, you have to bang them on the nose before they pay attention. A lot of people are going to be banged on the nose. And at some point, if you will, the weight of opinion will shift. I would say probably within a decade, but that is a sheer guess.
Well, John Steinbrenner, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with John Steinbrenner, Professor of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, where he directs the Center for International Security Studies. He's the author of a number of books, including The Cybernetic Theory of Decision, New Dimensions of Political Analysis, Principles of Global Security, and A New Concept for Cooperative Security. He co-chairs the Committee on International Security Studies of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and was the lead author on a report on climate change by the National Research Council that was commissioned by the CIA and other intelligence agencies.
And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the end of the Reagan era.
Yes, sir, we're having a heat wave, a tropical heat wave. The way that she moves that thermometer proves that she certainly can.
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck.
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul.
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J.
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu.
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin.
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich.
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith.
Sit down, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Lind, the co-founder of the New American Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He is co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. And he has an article at Salon.com, Final Defeat of Backlash Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Thank you, Ian.
And you're suggesting that this just completed election, in effect, is the end of the Reagan era. In fact, in your article at Salon.com, The Final Defeat of Backlash Politics, you say, no doubt some Reaganite conservatives will continue to fight the old battles, like the Japanese soldiers who hid on Pacific Islands for decades, fighting a war that had long before been lost. Quite a graphic picture you paint there.
Well, the press has gotten this wrong by treating this as a vote for the status quo, because the Republicans' majority was returned in the House. The truth is that the Democrats won a popular majority of the vote for president, for the Senate, and for the House of Representatives. Actually, more votes were cast for Democratic members of Congress than for Republican members of Congress. The only reason there's a majority in the House of Representatives for the Republicans is that Republican state legislatures gerrymandered congressional districts after the 2010 census, permitting the Republicans to have a majority in the House, even though they received a majority of the votes. So it really is a remarkable wave election, particularly because it took place at a time when many of the economic indicators are so bad still during the recession. So that does really seem to be the end of an era and the beginning of a new one.
Well, we were talking earlier about that anomaly, not so much that the House Republicans got less votes than the House Democrats, who are in the minority, but about Karl Rove's engineered 2010 takeover of the House, the biggest donor to the Republicans, of course, being the American Petroleum Institute. And thus we have global warming denial. But one of the points that was made is that unless the Obama administration in 2014 unleash the kind of ground game and assets that they have to win this election, that they treat the 2014 election like they treated the 2012 election, then we may go back to the status quo. Would you agree that that's the challenge?
Well, sure. The Republicans, even apart from redistricting and gerrymandering, might pick up some seats in both the House and the Senate in the midterms in 2014. That tends to happen in ordinary times in midterm elections. But I think that the progressives and the Democrats can take a certain amount of confidence in the fact that in the long term, things are moving in their direction. It's not just demography, it's policy. You know, basically, the Republicans are wedded to policies that are simply anachronistic in the second and third decades of the 21st century. And that on every single front, essentially, their views are not consonant with what the public wants. They're more hawkish. They want to be more aggressive in the Middle East. The vast majority of Americans, including, I'm sure, many Republicans, do not want another war in the Middle East after Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya against Iran or intervention in Syria. On social issues, the census data shows that every generation of Americans, including white southern working class Americans, is more liberal on social issues than their parents and grandparents. So they're losing on the long term on social issues. And finally, on economics, we'll see what happens with the fiscal cliff and the supposed grand bargain. But with every year, more and more Americans are retiring. And I think it will get harder and harder for the Republicans to achieve their goal of repealing or significantly cutting back Social Security and Medicare. So, I just don't see much of a future for the party either with its present demography or with its particular policy agenda.
Well, it does seem ironic that now the House of Representatives, which was always referred to as the People's House, and conversely the U.S. Senate was often referred to as the Money House. It seems that, not to suggest that the Senate doesn't still operate on money, but that the House is, given the contours of this debate coming up over the fiscal cliff, it's going to become increasingly apparent as the Republicans box themselves into their insistence on preserving tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, that they're really going to the mat for the millionaires and billionaires.
Well, there's a certain amount of logic to that, both on the demographic and the economic front. To begin with, senators like presidents and also like governors in mayors of big cities face electorates, particularly in the medium-sized, larger states, that look like America, with a growing Latino population, substantial Black population, a much larger group of secular people. Obviously, it varies in different regions of the country. But senators, for that very reason, tend to be more moderate and to be more sympathetic to the concerns of this emerging demographic majority in the U.S. than a member of the House elected from a 95% non-Hispanic white district need be.
Gerrymandered.
Exactly. That's a gerrymandered district. What's more, the senators, precisely because it's been referred to as a millionaire's club, a lot of the senators are rich, and a great number of them are self-financed. However, your right-wing Tea Party Republican from the gerrymandered, you know, all non-Hispanic white district typically refer, and this is true of Democrats as well as Republicans, it's not just the Republicans, these are kind of rotten boroughs which depend on outside money. Money from a few big coastal cities, of which New York and Wall Street are particularly important. But also for the Democrats, you know, it's L.A. and San Francisco. So that's true in general of Congress. Members of Congress raise a lot of their money from the rich on the two coasts, not from their own constituents. And so you've got this otherwise inexplicable coalition of the white working class Southern descendants of people who voted against Wall Street with William Jennings Bryan with Wall Street, because Wall Street provides the money and the district provides the voters.
Well, it's pretty clear. I saw an interview with Michael Lind, with the head of the Tea Party, on CNN after the election, and she was absolutely not going to say that we had to tax the 2%. She kept talking.
Well, you know, I'm not a great fan of Patrick J. Buchanan.
Right.
I've criticized him for years, but he's a genuine right wing populist, and he made the proposal years ago that no member of Congress should be able to raise any money outside of his or her district. If you had a ban on outside of district fundraising, I think, you know, these right-wing populists would have a quite different economic agenda than they actually do.
And of course, the old joke, Michael, was that the Republicans don't just want to go back and repeal the New Deal under FDR. They actually want to go back to the other Roosevelt and repeal.
Well, of course, Romney wanted us to go back to the World War One Navy.
That's true. That's kind of close to Teddy Roosevelt. But one of the things that I found extraordinary about this election is that it was pointed out that the red and blue map of the United States that results in this polarized country where, the president was only ahead 3 million in the popular vote, even though he'd got a resounding victory in the Electoral College. It was pointed out that red and blue map is very similar to the map just before the Civil War, before Fort Sumter.
Well, this is not a new development. It's been happening for decades. If you look at U.S. history, there have always been two national parties. They've gone under different names. One is based in New England and the Great Lakes Midwest area that was settled chiefly by New Englanders. That was called the Federalist, then it was the Whig Party, then it was the Republican Party from Lincoln up until Eisenhower and Nixon. Nowadays, it's the Democratic Party. They've changed names. The other party is the Southern Party. It was based in the South, with alliances among mostly white working class Irish and later Italian immigrants in the Northeast and the Midwest, which were just alliances of convenience against the dominant white Protestant group in the Northern Party, and that has been called the Jeffersonian Republicans, the Democratic Republicans, the Democrats, and of course now it's called the Republicans, confusing everybody. But if you look at maps, the continuities are there, even though the names keep flipping around. And the one time this North-South political map was blurred was the New Deal era between Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson, when because of the memory of the Depression was associated with Herbert Hoover, the Republicans, apart from Eisenhower, were pretty much out of power during the mid-20th century. And you had this unusual omnibus Democratic Party, which included Northern progressives and Southern conservatives and Midwestern populists, and that all broke down at the end of the 60s with the Civil Rights Revolution and the Cultural Revolution. So in a way, we simply reverted to the historical pattern. If you look at the red state map, you really should discount the mountain and prairie states because there are very few human beings in them. So it really is much more north-south than it is red state, blue state.
Yeah, the Dakotas are pretty much an anomaly. But it does, when you mention the Civil Rights Act of 1965, of course, a part of that is the Voting Rights Act, and now that's just gone to the Supreme Court, and we've already seen the Supreme Court overturn the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law that's had profound effects, as we can see from this election. Is it possible, then, that the Supreme Court will be more and more isolated as a kind of reactionary court, as it was under Roosevelt when he was trying to, when the country was trying to move forward, their job was
to... That's a real danger, because if you assume that the present Republican Party is doomed, at some point there will be a new Republican Party that will win elections again, and it will be more up-to-date and so on, but it could take a while. But essentially, when parties lose in the United States, first they lose the presidency, then they lose the Senate, and then the last thing they may lose is the House. But if you overcome this gerrymandering problem, and if that's the case, the last real right-wing Republicans in the federal government may be justices of the Supreme Court. And because of lifetime tenure, this has happened repeatedly throughout American history. So, for example, in the late 19th century, when the U.S. was challenged with the growth of large corporations and the railroads, and you had all sorts of progressive reforms and even moderate reforms, you had these elderly justices whose views of economics had been formed in the pre-industrial agrarian era of the Jacksonian period. They were just striking down laws right and left because it went against what they were taught about economics in the 1830s and 1840s, you know, half a century later. And the same thing happened in the 1930s, where you had a reactionary court kept striking down New Deal reforms, including the National Recovery Administration, because it didn't fit with the economic views of the 1890s. So I think that's a legitimate concern. You may have elderly judges as the last bastions of Reaganism in the 2020s and 2030s.
So, Michael Lind, in terms, though, of how the country might move forward, and, you know, we just prior to you, we did a piece on global warming with the lead author of a report commissioned by the CIA at the National Research Council on the realities of global warming. And of course, the anomaly there is that the rest of the world notices it. And here's the United States, because of largely because the Republican Party has been captured by global warming deniers, and, you know, probably funded by the American Petroleum Institute, we're in essentially endangering ourselves, not to mention the planet. It's pretty extraordinary. So,
I think global warming is real. I think that the progressives have undercut their case by two things. For one thing, many progressives, including Al Gore, have grossly exaggerated the pace of global warming, you know, by treating things you know, like the melting of the ice caps and the flooding of permanent flooding of cities and so on, which may take place over several hundred years, as though it's something that's going to happen in the near future. Well, if you're Hollywood, you can do that. But if you're trying to alert the public and you make apocalyptic predictions that don't materialize, notwithstanding Hurricane Sandy, the point is that the entire seaboard is not underwater and isn't going to be in the foreseeable future, then you discredit yourself, and it actually helps the deniers if you engage in too much hype. The other mistake that the progressives made was, instead of focusing on the goal, which is mitigation of global warming by reducing greenhouse gases, they fetishized certain kinds of energy, specifically solar and wind power, and delegitimized other forms of energy which can also contribute to reducing greenhouse gases, namely natural gas, which has only half of the CO2 of coal. It's not perfect, but it would be an improvement. And also nuclear energy, which emits no carbon dioxide at all. And it has a local concentrated waste problem, but it's not going to fry the earth, you know, even if it contaminates a couple of counties. So I think the progressives really need to rethink their strategy. They need to be more open to debate about different kinds of energy that can contribute to global to greenhouse gas mitigation, including nuclear and natural gas instead of coal. And they also, and finally, you know, the other mistake has been to focus entirely on mitigation rather than adaptation. But as I understand the science, even if you ended all greenhouse gas emissions tomorrow, sheer inertia would continue to warm the atmosphere for generations to come. And that means that you're already going to have kind of sort of, not forgive the pun, but baked in global warming.
Sure. But that doesn't mean
to which we're going to have to adapt. So
sure.
you need a simultaneous strategy of mitigation, reducing future emissions, but also of adaptation, including storm barriers around Manhattan, for example, to reduce the effects that's already kind of baked into the system.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Michael Lynn, back to your piece at Salon.com, The Final Defeat of Backlash Politics. If we are, if the Reagan era has ended and a new progressive era is about to begin, the last thing that the president can do is sell out on Social Security in these negotiations over the fiscal cliff.
Well, this is a real danger because a blue majority has reelected a purple president, a president who, moreover, in my view, in many ways represents the past, not the future. That is, Obama, like Clinton, was shaped as a politician during the Reagan era. And so his instincts, like Clinton's, are that he's playing from a position of weakness and that he has to prove his centrism by going halfway with all these conservative things. Now, that probably was true for Clinton at the height of the Reagan era. So I give Clinton a certain amount of slack for this. But if Obama makes all these preemptive concessions on Social Security, on Medicare, and so on, it, notwithstanding the fact that in the long term his side is winning, then I think he really will endanger his legacy and also hurt Democrats and the national interest going forward. So that should be a cause of concern.
Well, Michael Lynn, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Lynn, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed, and his latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. He also has an article at Salon.com, The Final Defeat of Backlash Politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/IanMasters/IanMastersMedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. Bye.